Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 16, Speakers and Ears. There, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. My guest geek of the week is Paul Barton, founder and chief designer of PSB Speakers for the last 38 years. Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, I've been wanting you on for a long time because you and I go back a ways, and I know you got some really interesting ideas about speakers and so on. But let's start with the fact that you're actually a trained musician, just as I am, and this is one of the commonalities we share. Why don't you tell us a bit about your background there?
Well, I started studying violin at a very young age. My father, who was a trained tenor and practiced it quite extensively when I was young, it was always singing in the house. And when
just
I was six,
it was in my house, yeah.
Yeah. When I was six, he introduced me to the violin and actually started very early with private lessons. And actually, by the age of nine, I had grown enough to warrant in the fairly near future a full-size violin. As you're younger, you can't play a big violin. Your arms aren't long enough. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we talked yesterday and I mentioned that my father, at age nine, started and finished when I was 11 to build me my first full-size violin. And
He built it himself?
Yeah, he built it in our garage. First, he spent a year studying the violin and got plans, actually, for a violin called, it's a Stradivarius violin called the Messiah, which had been built specifically for show only, and is actually to this date has never been played.
Really?
But it was very, very highly documented. And so he built the frames and all the clamps and the scrapes, and it took him about a year to do that, and then a year to actually assemble the violin around the frame that you build. When you build a violin, you build it around a mold that you make, and then you take the mold out of the violin after you put the back on it, and then you put the front on. Huh. Actually, as we talked yesterday, I mentioned I actually have the violin here. I can show it to you.
Oh, yeah. Those of us who are on video Skype should definitely – I'd love to see it.
Now, it's quite unique in that, along with the design of the violin, my father also mimicked the color of the violin, which is a very bright orange color.
This is the same color as the Stradivarius on which it is modeled?
Yeah. And you can see the back is made of maple.
Uh-huh.
And this symbol at the bottom is a purfling, which is gouged in of a strip of ebony sandwiched over top of some maple. And it gives you
this incredible
pattern. And then all around the edge, of course, the violin has purfling, which is to prevent cracking from going from the side of the violin to the outside. And that's done on the front and the back.
Yeah.
And this is a full-size copy of the Strad.
Now, was your dad a luthier as well as a singer?
Well, he learned how to do this on his own. He didn't really study. He only built one.
That's incredible. Was he a woodworker otherwise? I mean, did he build like furniture or anything like that?
Well, he built, some furniture around the house, but nothing. Actually, the first piece of major furniture he and I built together was a pair of loudspeakers.
Wow. And what age were you then?
I was probably about 12 or 13 at that time.
Wow. So a precursor to your future career, huh?
Absolutely. And, the first hi-fi we ever had, which was stereo. In fact, actually, the first hi-fi I ever had was a Seabreeze mono tube driven with a 10-inch full range driver in it. And I listened to a lot of music on that. But the first full stereo system we had, which we hooked these two new loudspeakers up to, was a product, actually, believe it or not, called Rotel.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, that was very early on. And so I built the very first speakers that with my dad, and finished them in some very, we did them in mahogany at the time. That was a very popular wood veneer at the time. And a very simple box with a generic driver. But one thing I did start to learn about at that point was what a bass reflex works like.
I was going to ask you about that.
It was a tuned port. This was long before Teal and Small had done all their work and on consolidating all the speaker parameters for efficient and modeling of loudspeaker designs. So I was sort of dabbling in it at a very young age. I like to take things apart just so I could figure out how to put them back together. That was something I did a lot. I was a hobbyist. I built the Heath kits and I built the Dynacos and I did all those things back in those days.
Mm-hmm. As many geeks did, you know, I too like to take things apart and put them back together fix the technical parts. I was always the tech guy around my house. You probably were too.
Well, I am. In fact, right now I'm sitting in front of, three monitors here and one monitor back here. And I usually have multitasking going on all the time.
I don't know how you can do that. Or the young kids today, particularly, seem to be able to multitask, you know, by texting and doing homework and watching TV and listening to music all at the same time. I can't understand any of that. I have to focus on one thing at a time. I don't even listen to music while I'm working.
Well, in contrast, when I'm working, I actually am more focused. In fact, you mentioned, and I'll get into it a little bit later, about the National Research Council and all the stuff that has gone on there and continues to take place. But where was I? I was talking about my father building the violin, and of course I studied violin, and I think for the most part became fairly competent. It was a potential career for me, and I played with several symphony orchestras at a very young age. I lived in Kitchener, which is about an hour away from Toronto, Ontario. Mm-hmm. And every Saturday morning after I turned 16 and was able to drive a car, I would drive to the University of Toronto music department to play in the University of Toronto Repertoire Orchestra, which was kind of fun and gave me a lot of experience in playing just about every piece of classical music written for orchestra. Mm-hmm. Because this was an orchestra developed put together to help teach conductors how to conduct an orchestra. So we were there just as guinea pigs to allow the conductors to learn how to play. But it was a good experience for me, and I did that very young. And then I played with the National Youth Orchestra of Canada for a couple of years when I was young, and that's quite a position to be in as far as the stepping stones to become an accomplished musician. Mm-hmm. But then when I finished high school, I'd already been dabbling. I worked in a hi-fi store near the University of Waterloo. And during the week, because my dad had this little wood shop where he'd built the violin and I was building a few speakers here and there for friends, I put these kits together, which were made up of drivers that I purchased at a local electronics company called Electrohome. And they had a lot of spare parts and things in their service department. And I used to go there and buy all these parts and then cut up panels of wood and design a crossover and put these speakers together as kits and sell them in the hi-fi store to the university students who could actually put them together with a screwdriver and a soldering iron in their dorms. Mm. And there were these big, huge 12-inch three-way, 6-inch mid-range and a horn tweeter. Mm. And they just rocked and rolled. And I did fairly well doing that sort of thing. So through high school, I sold hi-fi on the weekends in the stores and sold my speaker kits and started to build the odd little model. And then I joined forces the summer of 72 with two of my high school buddies. It was the year we finished high school. That fall, I was scheduled to go to the University of Waterloo. But we as a group decided to start the company, and they decided to take a year off before they go to university. And I went to university in a co-op program where I studied for 4 months, and then you go to some related work-related job, if you can find it, for 4 months, and you alternate throughout your university career. Mm. Well, I would employ myself during my work terms.
You had already started PSB Speakers at that point.
Right. I started it the summer before I started university. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was kind of an interesting situation because that kind of scenario had not really been popular in the university. And actually, just as a bit of an anecdotal point, I'll mention that after each four-month term while I was working, I would get a letter in the mail from the university to the president of PSB to do an evaluation.
Which was you.
Yeah, right. So I was able to do my own evaluations. And my guidance counselor and I used to get a kick out of it because there was really no mechanism for self-employment in this kind of scenario. And they let me do it this way because I had started the company.
Right.
Then in 1974, a magazine editor here in Canada who had seen one of our ads promoting a servo feedback speaker that I had designed that year, or just earlier the year before, later the year before, which was a servo feedback, motional feedback loudspeaker we called the Beta 2. Beta meaning feedback. It has the feed forward would be alpha and feed back would be beta. And this speaker, you know, was kind of a challenging product for a small Canadian loudspeaker company, and it got his attention. And he invited me to meet him in Toronto at their magazine. It was owned by a large conglomerate magazine called McLean Hunter. And we sat together, and at that time, he was doing his speaker reviews with the help of Floyd Toole at the National Research Council.
So right, who's been a guest on the show already a couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay, good. Well, yeah. Say hi to Floyd for me.
I will.
He's probably told you some of this story, and early in mid 74, I was invited up to meet Floyd, and through the help of Ian Masters, the editor of this magazine in Canada, and I went up and visited Floyd, and we kind of hit it off. And at that time, there was really no mechanism in place for outside industry to utilize those kinds of facilities. So for a period of time, I just sort of came there and, you know, hung out and designed speakers and learned and observed. And I was in the middle of all this activity that happened between, well, even before I got there, until about 1981, 82. At which point all this activity at NRC had accumulated into quite a nice body of work, which over the next several years Floyd published in the Audio Engineering Society, some of the results of these double blind screen listening tests and correlating between the listening experience and loudspeaker measurements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which we did talk about extensively, yeah.
Right, and so PSB was kind of there at the very beginning, and I was fortunate to make these acquaintances and be at the right place at the right time to take advantage, I guess you could say, of all of this activity, which, as we look back on it, turns out to be some of the most significant work done in this area to date. Mm. And much of which Floyd continued to do once he moved on to Harman in 1991.
In terms of the psychoacoustics of speakers and placing them in rooms and so on and so forth.
Further,
so
we talked. The initial work was to just sort of see what people liked in the sounds of different loudspeakers. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, of course, the next equation or the next challenge is to integrate that into a fairly hostile environment called a room. And it's an acoustic filter which has to be dealt with and sometimes can swamp all the things the speaker is trying to do because of the gross errors that a room can introduce based on the size, the shape, the position you are in the room, and the position the speakers are in the room.
Yeah.
And Floyd did a lot of work on that. Initially, some of the work was done through the Athena project, which took place between about 1987 and 1991, where there was a lot of psychoacoustic work done to correlate what effect the room has on listener experience and maybe trying to make some corrections on those modifications the room is making to the sound and see whether listener preferences can go up when a speaker is calibrated or EQ'd in a room. And of course, today we see a lot of systems with all the high-powered chips that are available that can process and do corrections for rooms in real time, something that was very difficult to do even back in the late 80s.
Sure.
We built a very large DSP engine with analog and digital boards that allowed us to do this kind of room correction, similar to what you see happening with maybe Odyssey, which is one company that's taken a lot of this technology and applied it, and I think is licensing it to a number of companies to be used in their home theater setups. Mm-hmm. And it works quite well. There are other systems also out there.
Some of them proprietary. Pioneer has a proprietary one. Yamaha has a proprietary one.
Yeah, and I think Athens has one.
Okay.
Which is developed here in Canada, actually.
Mm-hmm. A lot of audio stuff going on in Canada, and have been for a long time. Now, the National Research Council is a governmental body. Is that correct?
Yeah, just to describe it, it's a government-funded institution which employs about 1,000 PhDs in all of the sciences, from chemistry to physics to they have standards, building research, astrology.
Astrology?
Yeah, medical stuff. Astronomy, sorry.
And, you know, at one point past, those were the same thing, but they aren't anymore. Yeah.
Sorry, slip of the tongue. A good example of that would be, the Canada arm that's used on the space shuttle?
Yes.
Well, that was developed in conjunction with the National Research Council.
Hey, well, there you go.
And those are the kind of activities that you see happening there. So it's a really great environment. And we were speaking earlier about, multitasking, and quite the opposite occurs when I go to NRC. It's the building that I use to do the actual measurements and development of the product. Actually, there are two buildings that I use. One is the anechoic chamber, and the other is one of the wings of the old physics building, which is now part of standards and measurement, has the listening rooms. So when I'm doing development, I'm in my own building, literally, with no one else is in the building. It's very focused. I'm not disturbed by anyone, and I can sometimes spend 2 weeks almost in isolation just focusing on developing the product. So it's a nice getaway place, and I could probably duplicate a similar environment just about anywhere else, including where our offices are here in Toronto. But I really think having this sort of off-site location where I can really focus, has benefited. It gives me...
Sure, and you and your product. Are you the only commercial concern that is using the facility in this way, or do they allow anybody in, or...
Well, it's
a Canadian history.
Well, the Canadian, some of the criteria, and they have cooperated with American companies in the past, but the basic premise is that this support Canadian manufacturers or companies to do research or product development. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't apply just to this particular type of activity. It's across the board at NRC. They want to cooperate with industry.
Sure.
And currently, the division that Floyd was involved in, which was the acoustics division of the original physics department, which later got named the Institute for Microstructural Sciences. And that particular activity in acoustics, which was doing things like sound propagation, building barriers for noisy highways into residential areas, a lot of research in terms of sound propagation outdoors, a lot of research in terms of the human internal and external ear, all these activities taking place in this division. Well, this particular division has been dissolved in the last year, and the activity that I'm involved in, which is the anechoic chamber and the listening rooms where product is developed, is now being taken care of by what is considered to be called, or what is called, standards and measurements in Canada.
Okay.
And they're a well-funded support. Like, they do things like time and weight and measures and distance and all of these basic standards that Canada maintains, just like every country does.
Sure.
So the anechoic chamber activity and support of that is now under the guise of standards and measurement. And it's really great for me right now because of this change, or great for PSB, I guess, in general, is that we pretty much have a run of the place, and it's available to other people, and they really encourage other people to consider using the National Research Council. There's a daily nominal fee, but small by comparison to what it has to offer, and you can get a lot done.
Yeah.
So I continue to use the NRC in that way, and I can't see it changing in any way in the near to distant future. it's kind of my getaway place.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds fascinating. I hope I get to visit sometime.
Well, actually, you should come sometime. Many people you know have come up there. Tom Norton's been there. Mm. John Atkinson's been there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. People. Well, good. I will take that as a incentive to come up there and see, check it out for myself.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier something that I wanted to geek out a little bit on, and that was you mentioned feedback in terms of alpha and beta. And I wondered if you'd get into a little bit of what that means exactly in terms of speaker design.
Well, I was just mentioning that I designed a loudspeaker, and this is how all of this interest in PSB had got started, because it was a fairly ambitious project for such a young company. And that was a speaker that had an accelerometer. And you see them today, and I think Velodyne have some models that have a pickup right on the cone itself.
Mm.
And it senses the acceleration of the cone or the motion of the cone.
Mm-hmm.
That information is used to tell the amplifier whether the cone is actually behaving in the same way that the amplifier is telling it to behave. And if it doesn't, it can make those corrections.
Mm.
It's like having a feedback loop around. So the negative feedback loop of any system is called the beta. And the forward signal is called the alpha.
And what do you mean by the forward signal? The signal that's going to the cone.
Yeah. Like in medical terms, the beta is the feedback network. So when you pick up a glass of water, how do you know that you don't throw it in the air? Because you have feedback. There's a certain amount of feedback telling you how heavy that glass is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that information that's feeding back to the brain is called the beta signal.
And it's I didn't realize that. It's the classic example, of course, is when you reach for a carton of milk that you think is full, when in fact it's empty.
Yeah.
And for a second, and you lift it up, and it goes shooting up in the air until you realize, oh, my God, it's empty.
Yeah, right. And it's that beta, it's that sensation that's the beta that tells your brain not to use too much energy.
Mm.
And so I called the speaker the beta because it had that feature. It was able to feed back the information from the cone.
Now, so that was a powered speaker then?
Well, it was sort of semi-powered. It had its own preamplifier stage, which was inserted between the preamplifier output and the amplifier input, which then created a loop around the amplifier itself. So you had to plug the speaker in the wall, and you had to connect it with a separate wire and over and above the speaker connection between the preamplifier output and the main amplifier input. And some, you know, if you had a receiver that had a preamp out and a main amp in with two little bridge jumpers on the back. You'd remove those and you'd insert these four RCA jacks that came back from the loudspeaker into the two for each speaker. One, you know, left and right channel in that case. Back in those days, we just had stereo.
Sure.
Actually, Floyd had a pair of these speakers in his den for many, many... Oh, no, actually, he had them in his main living room for many years. And actually had a double pair. They were called the Beta 2 and the Beta 2 Slaves.
Huh.
Yeah, those were the good old days.
Now, did those have accelerometers on all of the drivers? I know that I've heard of servos on subwoofers.
Well, it was kind of an interesting combination. It was a full range speaker, but only the low frequency was feeding back. So I had to filter off the signal coming from the accelerometer and only feed the low frequency back into the output. And then I had a bypass circuit that fed all the rest of the frequencies around the circuit. And so it all summed again, and then it drove the speaker passively through a crossover network into the tweeter and the woofer.
That was a two-way design?
Yeah, it was a two-way design. Two-way 8-inch, something you don't see very often anymore.
An 8-inch woofer and a...
A 1-inch dome.
Mm-hmm. And so then we have the Alpha, which you referred to as feed forward. How does that work?
Well, I just mentioned that in contrast to Beta, as a feedback, the other side of the equation is the Alpha, which is the feed forward. So...
I see. Once the circuit gets the information from the accelerometer, it then sends a corrected signal, if you will, and that's the Alpha.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's what we call it.
And yet, you also have a line of speakers called Alphas.
Yeah, and nothing to do with feed forward. It's just a cool name. We actually named the Alpha. For years ago, back in the late 70s, when we were still in Waterloo, we made a back deck car loudspeaker, which was like one of these wedge-shaped speakers that you could put on a bracket and rotate. Mm-hmm. And we called that speaker the Alpha because it was so small. It was just a little tiny thing.
Mm.
And then Alpha the early 90s, we put together a system which was a very simple box design, trying to keep the costs down. In fact, the grill couldn't even be removed to save money. And we called it the Alpha. And the primary thing was to try and produce the least expensive speaker that had the most bang for the buck. Mm. And it sort of caught on because in 91, we got some really rave reviews. And the Alpha evolved over those years. Into a series called, what do we call it? The New Alpha, I guess. And then we made a couple other, excuse me. We made a couple other models called the Avet and the Alpha Mini or Elf. I don't know, a whole bunch of different ones. And in 1999, we developed the current Alpha, with one small change in the cabinet construction since then. So we've been producing the current Alpha for almost 11 years now. And I just noticed it got top ranking in Consumer Report this month. It won Budget Product of the Year in Stereophile a year and a half ago, whatever it is, 2 years ago. So. Sure. The thing is, it's got a life of its own. It's been a great product, and really makes me feel good when people can recognize that you can buy something that isn't too expensive, but it really does pay off.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned earlier that you had done some research on bass reflex speakers with, in other words, ported cabinets, and I wonder if you would talk a bit about that as compared to acoustic suspension, the old term for a sealed box, and which you prefer, or do you use both? How do you go about approaching speaker design with that particular thing in mind?
Well, the most popular style or conventional freestanding designs these days seems to be base reflex. Mm-hmm. Actually, when I first got in this business, it was acoustic suspension / infinite baffle, sealed box, whatever you want to call it. You know, the ARs and the Advents, these were all sealed, very high compliance drivers in sealed boxes.
What do you mean by high compliance drivers?
Very, very loose suspensions, which results in very low fundamental or resonant frequencies. And really what happens when you make the suspension of the loudspeaker extremely supple or very loose and you seal it in a box, you really make the air in the box the spring or the suspension of the system. So it becomes
the term acoustic suspension. I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah, it just really becomes the major dominant spring in the equation. I mean, you can put a loudspeaker in a sealed box, but if the suspension is stiffer than the air cushion that's inside the box, then the stiffness of the driver will dominate the performance of the system. Mm-hmm. So, but in bass reflex, it's a little more tricky because you have to tune these things a little more critically. And today's with today's modeling programs and the vast amount of experience in magnetic structures and a lot of modeling with regard to optimizing magnetic structures and soft parts, which can be modeled fairly well these days, you can design and optimize some pretty cost-effective drivers. And that's kind of what we try and do. They may not look any different than the rest, but it's really the, you know, you can have a plate of food on the table, but and they can both look pretty good, but one could taste terrible and the other can taste good. It's the ingredients. It's the ingredients that you use in it, and how it looks, and what materials it's made out of can sometimes influence it, but I would have to say it's kind of one of those things where it's like a recipe, you know, you just have certain combinations of things that really work well. And I think we try and do that with our designs.
Now, do you design your own drivers as well as the speakers? Oh, yeah.
We design everything ground up.
Wow. So it's because a lot of speaker companies, you know, they'll buy their speakers, their drivers from Seez or ScanSpeak or any one of a number of companies, but you're not one of them.
Well, to some degree, I guess you could say we're similar in that we don't build the drivers. We contract the drivers, but the drivers are sometimes based on platforms that exist, but not very often. Usually what we're looking for are not just performance issues, but also some aesthetic and mechanical issues like size and fitting them into systems that we want. So that you need to really design the baskets and design the... And the materials are something, I mean, the last time I did a major shop on materials was when we were developing the Imagine. And as you may or may not know, we build most of what we do in China. So it was one of these things, that very common practice is to actually literally go grocery shopping for what's available in China. And so...
So the drivers themselves are built in China as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you go shopping for the particular metal alloys you want for, say, metal domes or the...
Well, we'll see what's available, what's currently the materials that are being processed. I mean, a lot of people do a lot of work in research. I'm not going to ignore what other people have done in research and view and what seems to be up and coming or something that might... be experimental or some ideas that somebody has that I think are interesting. And this is how this cone that we use on the Imagine came about. It's like a standard polypropylene, but it has kind of a clay slurry in it and mechanically works very well as a good combination between stiffness and mass and damping, internal damping to make the cone behave well. And of course, being a fully commodity type material, polypropylene, it's not overly expensive. But it works very well.
Right. I assume one of the reasons you took your manufacturing to China is for that reason, for cost savings, which so many companies are doing. And yet, I'm sure you must have found manufacturers there who meet your standards.
Absolutely. In fact, they're eager to meet our standards. And, you know, like any country who's developing, I mean, I guess it happened in Japan, which eventually segued into Taiwan, where a lot of the Taiwanese style of manufacturing mimicked what Japan had done for many years. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the factories, in fact, two of the factories that we use to do our main work in China are actually Taiwanese owned. So a lot of the Taiwanese modeling of how a factory operates efficiently and, you know, productivity wise, as far as, you know, being cost effective and producing high quality products, very much came from that tradition of the developing country manufacturing. And these are very efficient plants that really are producing some excellent work. I mean,
I'm surprised that that China would allow Taiwanese companies to build plants in mainland China because of all the animosity between those two countries.
Well, that is interesting, and they've been working together as far as I can tell. I've been going there for about 11 years now, and they've been cooperating quite well. As a matter of fact, until recently, you couldn't take an airplane from mainland China to Taiwan, and now you can. So The relations between those two countries and the activities is actually getting much better.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear it. Mm. You mentioned earlier about bang for buck, and I wanted to get a little bit into that. That now that we're in economic hard times, people are looking for value more than ever. And I know that you had a few things you wanted to say about that.
Well, it's always been one of our strengths and one of our goals is to produce good value at any price range. And I think for the most part, certainly the press community out there have recognized, based on what I've seen in the last couple of years, that PSB kind of resonates that to people, and I'm really glad to hear it. It's certainly an effort on our part to do that. Like I said earlier, as far as the design is concerned, you know, you can use a lot of fancy materials and throw a lot of brute force at the designs, but that really isn't good design. It's when you can really maximize every aspect of it and make good trade-offs. We were talking earlier about the National Research Council, and much of what we've learned about loudspeaker design is based on the experiences gathered by all of that activity and all of the times and efforts that were spent trying to evaluate loudspeakers on the merits of their sound alone by using double blind screen testing, not knowing what it is you're listening to, and making judgments. I mean, even when I, particularly in the early days when I was sort of learning the ropes, trying to remove myself from the bias of, you know, I just designed a loudspeaker. How could it sound bad? And so I would want to, you know, put the speaker behind the screen so I would be fair to judge and judge myself so that I could improve. And over the years, you sort of learn what people like and what you like or what you don't like in a way a speaker sounds. And that's to do with the voicing and where you choose the crossover points, which ultimately affects the directivity of the driver in various frequency-dependent ranges. The speaker looks kind of simple. And one thing I always say, it's really quite easy to make a loudspeaker, but it's very difficult to make a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Part of making a good loudspeaker, I think, is to be able to do it without just a brute force approach, and that is throw the kitchen sink at it and hope that you haven't forgotten anything, rather than rather than design it knowing that that's not that important, or this one is important. And if we're going to throw some money at something, this is where you throw the money, because that'll make the difference. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how you achieve good value. And that's kind of what I like doing. I really get a kick out of putting a pair of loudspeakers up. And I can tell you many stories of the past where reviewers have come and subjected themselves to these double blind screen listening tests and were quite amazed at what they thought going into it versus what they discovered going through it and came out of it. And it was a real confidence builder for me as a speaker designer, because it kind of, you read a lot of people's opinions of things and you go, well, how can they think that? But when you take that same, when you take that same person and put them into a controlled test, that's not how they're thinking. They give you the same answer that everyone else gave.
In fact, I was fascinated that Floyd, in my talk with him on the podcast a couple weeks ago, said that one of the things they did at NRC was to determine, and continued on at Harman, was to determine the relationship or the correlation between objective measurements of a speaker and the subjective impressions of listeners in double-blind tests, so that one could actually design a speaker and have it measure a certain way and be able to predict with a fair amount of accuracy whether or not people in general would like the sound or not.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. So
Floyd, sorry about that.
Floyd I'm singing the same song as Floyd, no question about it.
Okay.
And it makes sense because, you know, we kind of came from the same era and same experiences in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And you have access to the same information that, you know, what are the objective measurement goals that you're aiming for? And because that's what will result in a speaker that people find pleasing. And well, then how can you...
Yeah, I don't just have access to it. I was there when that happened.
You were there during the research.
That's right. I was there the whole time.
Fascinating. Oh, that's just great. So, go ahead.
I remember when I was traveling, I think I told you, I was traveling about a month and a half ago. I was in the U.S. and the person that I was visiting mentioned that they had seen one of these shows or heard one of these shows on the internet and send me a link. It was when you were doing Kevin Vicks from Revell.
Oh, sure. Kevin Vicks.
Kevin Vicks. And I listened to part of it, and part of it was talking about him reminiscing about how he got started in the business. And
sure,
he actually got started at the same, well, he got started by PSB manufacturing his first designs. So
I don't know if I remember him saying that.
Yeah, you know how Mirage started.
Sorry?
He mentioned how Mirage loudspeakers started.
Yes, he did.
Well, we were the company that built them for him.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, well, Kevin used to come to my factory in St. Jacobs, and he would watch the production on the line. In fact, the original designs that he did were replacements for a brand that was being distributed in the U.S. called Tangent loudspeakers.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner of Tangent, who they had some financial trouble, had purchased the name back and was upset about them continuing to use the name, these new designs that Kevin had done that we were building for him. And I remember one day he came with new labels and new serial numbers, new owner's manuals and new logos. And in the morning we were building Tangent, and in the afternoon we were building Mirage.
Wow.
So that That's how Mirage got born.
Wow, because it was Tangent, and then the guy said, no, you can't use that name. So,
yeah,
that's how they went in another direction. That's incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, a lot of the Canadian loudspeaker companies and brands were really quite a small group of people. And we all crossed paths from time to time. We're all involved in some way. You know, in the late 80s, Floyd inspired a bunch of us companies to get together, form a company, and work with the government and NRC to do this smart speaker project called Athena. And that included PSB, API, which was Mirage and Energy loudspeakers, and then Paradigm loudspeakers, and another company out of Ottawa called State of the Art Electronics. They manufactured high-powered studio monitors for the professional industry, mm-hmm. and actually outfitted most of the CBC across Canada with their monitors. And so the four companies actually did this research with Floyd and the National Research Council. So, you know, over the years, many of these companies have worked together in conjunction.
A lot of cross-pollination and people moving from one company to another.
Excuse me, this cold, I'm still fighting it a little bit. I just got back from China and I got a cold when I was there.
Sure it's not the swine flu now?
No, I got my shot.
Oh, good. Yeah.
In fact, I was one of the first ones here in Canada to get it because I was just leaving to go, and that was back in November. No, October, I think I got it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, certainly you need to get it if you're going to China, I would say.
Well, if you're traveling anywhere, really.
I suppose. Yeah. Anyway, what is this Athena project? Can you give us a little more info on that?
Well, it was a 3.5-year project in cooperation. Like, we formed a company, the four companies I just mentioned, called CARC, the Canadian Audio Research Consortium. And that started in about 1987 and ran for 3.5 years. And it was really just trying to do the psychoacoustic correlation of problems in rooms and see if there was something that could be done in the digital domain to correct for room problems.
Ah.
And so an engine was developed that was able to do room corrections. Although back in those days, the application or the practicality of applying the hardware and software that had been developed, which was fairly code related, it wasn't very... didn't have much of a GUI or anything like this, made it very difficult to actually execute into a commercial product. Although the research that had been done was very useful in determining to another level, you know, what listener preferences were and how that related to listening in rooms. Mm-hmm. So a lot of good education and good direction was mapped out by all of this research that went on with the four companies. And we met regularly as a management group, the principals of all four companies, to, you know, collaborate on pre-competitive research, not competitive research, which would be developing a product around it.
Right. I love that approach, actually. I experienced the same thing in the pro audio realm in the 80s when this musical instrument language called MIDI was first developed, and I was on the board of directors of the MIDI Manufacturers Association. And what really struck me as being wonderful was that all of these competitive companies, Roland, Yamaha, Sequential Circuits at the time, Oberheim at the time, all got together. They sent their engineers into a room and said, we want a common way for our products to interact with each other and communicate musical information with each other. And we came out with MIDI, and that's now 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's still going strong. So it's just another example of the value of cooperation among what would otherwise be competitive companies. And here's another one.
Yeah, I think I don't know the current legal situation, but at the time, these kinds of consortiums that we formed in Canada in conjunction with the National Research Council, and we weren't the only consortium. There was the solid state consortium that worked on a lot of, you know, digital work and integrated circuits and things like that, is not very common or wasn't even legal, I think, in the United States because of non-competitive clause or non-competitive something. And I think that attitude is definitely changing, and certainly a very strong direction for the Canadian government / industry cooperation. And I think it's great, particularly in Canada, because, you know, NRC is unique to almost any country in the world as far as having a facility like the National Research Council that can be used to enhance our technology and knowledge. And because Canada is, you know, 1/10 the population of the U.S., it gives the Canadian base, and Canadians have been well known for the technology development around the world, and continue to be that way. And I think part of it is because of that attitude of cooperative work together.
Yeah,
we have a big competitor just south of us.
And I don't think the U.S. has anything like the NRC, to tell you the truth.
No, I don't think so. Not in the way it's structured and in the way, I mean, they have the facilities and the resources, but they're not packaged in that way in the U.S. Most of it's private, I think,
right,
in the U.S.
Exactly. Certainly the Harman facilities their multi-channel listening lab, and they've got 2 or 3 anechoic chambers, and but it's all privately funded.
Yeah. And it seems to be the modus operandi more in the U.S., than in a country like Canada. Although there are companies in Canada that do all their own research.
Sure.
In fact, right now there isn't a lot of research in loudspeakers or listener preferences going on right now. I mean, you can do so much, and then you start to, you know, get to a point where there are certain things that you can't overcome, and you sort of reach some limits. One thing that I am very interested in pursuing now is, as you are, I'm sure everyone's aware of, how many people use portable music players and PDAs and cell phones that have music and video and
iPods and such.
Yeah, and their entertainment is traveling with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the main medium for which, or the main device for which they play this medium, is through earpieces, earbuds, or headsets, or over the ear, on the ear type earphones. And NRC is internationally and has a very strong history in regard to not just acoustics, but in the understanding of the external and internal ear. And Dr. Edgar Shaw, who unfortunately just died recently at a ripe old age of about 93, is well known in the textbooks for the contribution he made when he worked with the National Research Council. He's in all the textbooks on the external ear, the pinna.
Which is the part that we call the ear when we look at somebody.
The way it's shaped, why is it shaped this way? How we sense direction? In fact, much of the work, I think Floyd even did all his PhD work in the ear world when he did his PhD on sound localization. A lot of very interesting work has gone on at the National Research Council and continues to go on in conjunction with some of the researchers and doctors that I've gotten to know over the years, who are doing some private work in this area and are doing some work in conjunction with some of the universities in New Jersey. And I'm really excited about doing some more research. I've already started to do some research on earbuds and earphones. And of course, the objective for me would be to see what we can do to produce a very high quality, high performance earpiece, parallel to the kind of achievements that I think we've achieved in loudspeakers themselves.
So you don't have a, you don't have such a product at this point, right? You're still in the research phase?
Yeah. Yeah. But I am working on it.
Mm. Both on earbuds and earphones over the ear.
Yes. Yeah.
Because those are two, it seems to me, those are two very different problems.
Well, one uses the pinna and the other one doesn't.
Right. Exactly. Which is a very big difference if you ask me.
Yeah. Everyone has a different pinna. And that's the big challenge, is that the differences that we may end up having to deal with are ones that are because everybody's ear is a little different.
And so the over-the-ear headphone, everyone will perceive that slightly differently because of the difference in the shape of that pinna, the outer ear.
That, and also that the same would apply, is because if you eliminate the pinna, then over the ear, in the ear, your ear is relying on the pinna that you have. So if the recording was done, let's say it was done with a dummy head that's trying to reproduce everything that happened in the external ear, and then when you put the earbud in, it's using the external ear of the environment that it was recorded in and not yours. So you're not used to the way that one sounds. So that,
yeah, this is, by the way, just for people to know, is called binaural recording. And it's done by taking a dummy head, as you said, placing little microphones right in the ears, right in the middle of the pinna where the ear canal would be, and recording a concert or whatever using that microphone setup. And as you said, I think rightly so, and I hadn't even really thought of this before, that whatever the shape of the pinna is on that false head is what you're going to hear. The effect of it is what you're going to hear, not your own pinna, and that's going to sound a little weird.
That's right, and that's the challenge. And I'm trying to understand that whole phenomenon a little better. And, you know, you think it's just a little object on the side of your head, but it's a very complex shape, and how the sound hits it and how different frequencies propagate depending on what angle they come in at. Mm-hmm. That's how we hear. I always like to mention something about not only hearing, how should I say this? We have two ears, but we also have a brain, and the brain is doing a lot of work. And give you an example. if you're in a environment where you're having a conversation in, say, your office, and you're listening to someone who's on the other end of the phone, who's on a speakerphone, you can usually tell that they're on a speakerphone.
Sure. There's more ambience, there's more room in the sound.
Right. And my question to you would be, if you were in that room, would you hear that same kind of sound?
Hmm. I would have to say to some degree, but not entirely.
Right. And do you know that it's the same in the room as it is when you hear it through the microphone, but your brain is actually processing that other stuff out?
When you're in the room.
Right. And it's because you have two ears. And because you have two ears, you can triangulate and you can eliminate things that come at different times.
Wow. So, whereas with the speakerphone, you have one microphone.
Oh, you have no way of hearing direct direction. So you can't in a time domain based on direction, process that information out of what you're hearing. So that it suppresses the room. And, you know, we evolved in environments where intelligibility was a part of survival. Mm-hmm. And in order for us to survive in an environment that's fairly reverberant, we have to be able to triangulate and be able to eliminate the sounds so that we can survive. We have to know where it's coming from, and we have to understand what it is. And, you know, that's all part of how our hearing process works. And I find it extremely fascinating. And I'll even go a bit further in this dialogue about how we hear. And you often hear people talk about, and to some degree they're right, but not to the degree I think a lot of people would like to believe. And that is, you hear a lot about a lot about component break-in.
Component what?
Break-in. I don't want to listen to my speakers until they've been playing for 400 hours.
Break-in. Right. Gotcha.
Right. And I believe this phenomena is real.
Really?
But I don't. I don't believe it's the mechanical device, the phono cartridge, the motor on the CD player, or whatever you want to call it.
Speaker diaphragms,
or the suspension of the system. What I think it is, and I'm pretty sure it is it's us actually adapting and breaking into the system.
So it's us breaking in, not the speakers breaking in.
Don't laugh. It's real. And people observe it and people hear it. It's real.
Wow.
I'll give you an example.
Okay.
We talked a little earlier about double blind screen testing and all the work that was done at NRC. It was pretty clear in the beginning, noted strongly by Floyd, as more and more tests were being done, it was clear to everyone that when you looked at the results of the first rounds of all the tests, so a test would take place where two or three or four people would start in the morning, maybe around 9:30, and listen for about 40 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. Excuse me. Then we take a break and maybe take a 20-minute break, because listening is a fairly fatiguing thing. It requires a lot of concentration.
Sure.
And it was always interesting because in the beginning, most of the people that were doing these tests were doing them as rookies for the first time. So they hadn't really experienced a lot. They didn't know what to expect. They were just asked to sit down and make some judgments. So you'd ask a group of people that had been in there maybe for the first time or maybe had some experience in it, and you put up four reasonably good loudspeakers behind the screen. And they'd come out of the room after the first round going, you know something? I can't hear a difference between any of them.
Hmm.
And it's true. You know, when I go in the room, I go, man, you know, these sound really similar. But after the second round, you go into the room, it's almost like, wow, did they change all these speakers? Because now I hear that one's a little brighter. That one's got a little suck out in the mid-range. That one's... And they're all the same speakers. And it was clear to me that what was happening is that people were becoming... The room is this huge filter that's just there no matter what you listen to. It's just there. It's a filter. Well, we actually have the ability to kind of subtract that filter from the equation. And once we do that, and we can't do it to 100% degree, but we definitely can do it, then... those differences between the loudspeakers become much more profound because now we're processing the room out. And
takes some time to do that.
Absolutely takes time. Takes some people longer than others. You know, maybe if you've done this test in the room before, you can recall the filter you needed. I really don't understand that level of processing, but I know it's pretty obvious to me that that's something like that is happening. Hmm. That people... And I notice it, you know, when you're in a room, you start. I mean, if you listen really closely, you can hear the room more, or you just don't pay attention, and the room goes away.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the ears changing. It's not the acoustics changing. That's our perception is changing, and the only way we can change that perception is how we process the sounds in our brain.
Well, this brings up another question that I would love to ask you because I've been thinking about it a lot lately myself. And you mentioned it, you alluded to it earlier, the difference between trained or experienced listeners and those who are naive, untrained, we should say. This came up particularly in regard to the question about whether or not exotic cables, speaker cables, let's say, make a significant difference in the sound. You know, I mean, Nordost Odin speaker cables cost $20,000 for a 1 meter pair.
Right.
You know, and how much better is that than, you know, say $100 pair of Monsters or even, you know, 16 gauge lamp cord?
Well,
and the question is, Can non-experienced or non-trained listeners hear a difference? Can trained listeners hear more of a difference? I tend to think the latter. The training.
Well, trained listeners can come up with an answer a lot quicker. And if it's a really difficult answer, maybe the untrained listener would require a lot of training before they could hear it. That is true.
Same thing with speakers, I would assume.
Absolutely. But speaker differences are much bigger than the differences you would expect to see or hear on speaker cables. Mm-hmm. Like, speaker differences are huge by comparison.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess, what was your question?
Well, I was just asking about the difference between whether or not trained listeners make an important difference.
Yeah, well, trained listeners come up with the answer much more quickly.
Yeah, okay.
I think you mentioned earlier about these exotic cables, and I think I know for a fact that some of these exotic cables actually have filters in them that actually change the way it sounds. So, yeah, you can hear a difference because they're consciously changing the way it sounds. They have bulges in the cables, and if you open them up, there's filters in there.
Yeah,
so they're actually modifying the signal. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a difference, and if that's what you think sounds better, then great. But my question would be, you always have to ask the, and this has always been my goal, you always have to ask the fundamental question is, when I listen to a system, whether it's stereo or multi-channel, if it's produced by a musician / producer / engineer, I would like to think that when you listen to that system or listen to that music on a system, that the system is really just a window through which you're viewing the acoustic event. Mm. It doesn't have a tint on it. But sometimes that wire can, you know, when you put those glasses on that make everything look brighter? And you
sure.
go, wow, that's the way I want to see the world. All right. Bigger than life. Well, that's fine. If that's what you want.
Right.
But I'd like to think, and if you want to do that, you can modify the signal after you get the pure signal. I hate to think that you're always having to deal with this filter or this impure tinted glass. And then if you want to hear something that isn't tinted, how do you undo that? But if you have something that's clear, then you can tint it any color you want.
Sure, after
but
the
you
fact.
But you got to start with something that's clear. And I'd like to think that when you listen to our speakers, that you're actually getting as close to what was originally intended on the recording. Because the art form ends at the point where it's coming out of the mixing console or the tape recorder or whatever medium they're using to the actual recording. That's where the creative part stops and the reproduction part begins.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to create anything more than was, or you can if you want, but I'd like to think that you have wouldn't everyone like to have the opportunity to do this from ground zero and make the changes accordingly rather than have to live with this modification that's in everything you listen to?
Well, that brings up another very interesting question that I'm actually going to ask next week's guest in much more detail, but whether or not it's really possible to have a reproduced sound of, say, a concert, a performance, musical performance of some sort, and whether or not it's even possible to make that reproduced recording indistinguishable from an actual live performance. What's your thought on that?
Oh. Well, you could with some very well set up binaural recording with insert earphones that go right down to the eardrum. And I've actually experienced that kind of realism in sound reproduction.
You have?
Yeah. When we were doing the Athena project, one of the projects was to try and used the dummy head, which at the time was called Keymar, where there are two microphones at the end of the ear canal with artificial ears on a dummy torso. And that torso was attached to a rotator or a tracker on a chair in a room. And this was during the Athena project. And I can remember sitting in a bench in a room beside this with a sensor underneath my seat so that whenever I moved my seat, the dummy head would move in the room right to left.
In the corresponding manner, yeah.
Yeah, it would rotate so that I could also control the location of the ears as they swiveled back and forth in the other room. Mm. And one of the things we have a lot of difficulty in doing is simulating the frontal, what's up in front of us. Like when we're blind, if somebody walks beside you, you can definitely tell they're beside you. But as they walk in front of you, it becomes rather vague. And it's because we have eyes in the front and our ears don't really need to help us there because we can see what's in front of us. But the only way that I could really tell that there was a strong center image is if I moved the torso head. So if I moved the ear locations in the room, then the image became very strong. And that, to me, was taking that realism just to another level where you need to really not only do binaural hearing, but you also have to be able to do tracking. Because our ears are always floating around moving, hearing sounds that come to our ears from different angles. As the frequency response changes, as our ears move around, it becomes part of the illusion, or the not the illusion, it becomes part of the reality of what we're actually hearing. So that's the level at which you'd have to get to in order to create a perfect realism, and that is having the recording, as you track your head, the frequency response that's associated with the ears moving in different directions with a constant sound field would also have to be simulated. And that technology does exist.
Yes, isn't it? One company that's working on it is a company called Smythe Research, I believe.
Right.
Do you know them?
I've heard of them, and I find this type of research very fascinating.
Yeah,
it's
I
all
do too.
Part of this. It's all part of the new 3D world.
Yes, yes, exactly. One thought that occurred to me just here while you were talking about that was, if you did a binaural recording with microphones in the dummy head, and you moved your head around as you were recording, that's all well and good. But then when you reproduce it, that's what you hear, regardless of where your head is you listen.
That's why the tracker part of it is the missing link. Mm-hmm. That's what really, especially with images in front. So if you're sitting, if the dummy head is in an orchestra, if the dummy head is sitting in a theater and an orchestra is playing,
right?
You have the ability to move your head around. You do move it around whether you know it or not,
right.
And you wouldn't listen to a concert in one stationary position because part of the audible enjoyment is your ability to move your head around and then hear the environment and hear it change as you move your head around. Well, you can't do that if you do a dummy recording. So that level of realism can't be reestablished unless there's some link between your head position and the head position of the actual recording.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually put a tracker on your head and I'm sure do, if not rough, fairly accurate frequency shaping, frequency response shaping that would correlate with the head position that you're currently in.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
you would just have these filters always actively working as you move your head around, and there'd be a tracker on your head that would associate head position with a frequency response.
Ah, and then use DSP simulate the effect of moving your head in that acoustic environment.
Yeah, and lots of people have done measurements of this sort to profile the kinds of differences that are required and then eventually take that realism to another level.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of interesting stuff.
Very interesting stuff. Well, there's just one more topic I'd like to cover with you for a few moments, which you mentioned to me the other day, which is your work in wireless and powered speakers.
Right.
Well, what are you doing in that regard?
Over the years, let's take it one step at a time. As loudspeakers go, it really makes sense to design a loudspeaker and associate it with an amplifier, because you can do a lot of stuff in the electronic domain that you can't do as well or as easily in the passive domain, which is currently the way most loudspeaker amplifier configurations are set up. You buy your amplifier, you buy your loudspeaker. Well, to me, that's silly, because why not just put the amplifier with the loudspeaker? And then the amplifier can be shaped and modeled and optimized for not only value, but performance for that loudspeaker.
I've often thought the same thing myself.
The big problem is there's this sense that you need to buy your own amplifier. And so what people say is, well, that speaker's way too expensive. Well, no, it's not too expensive because you don't have to buy an amplifier. Now, most of the electronics companies don't have the kinds of offerings and flexibility in non-powered electronics. And that becomes a choice issue with a lot of people. They don't have a lot of choices when it comes to powered loudspeakers. But I think it's the future. I think for one real good reason, not the only reason, I mentioned one of the reasons earlier, and that is it makes sense to put them together because you can optimize them. But also, there's a growing desire for people to be a lot more flexible in location. And the fact that a speaker is wireless is a very strong lifestyle preference for a lot of people.
When you're saying wireless in this case, you're talking about having the amplifier in the speaker, so there doesn't need to be a speaker wire going to it.
Right. And
however, there still has to be a power cord. You have to put it near a power outlet because the amp needs power, right?
Yeah, you need power. And that's always going to be the ball and chain that's attached to a loudspeaker, if you want to say it that way.
Sure.
But it gives flexibility on running infrastructure, and it gives flexibility on making changes. Most people have power outlets just about everywhere. And it's not too difficult to plug a lamp in or some electronic device or a computer. So finding a location to plug a loudspeaker in. And the future holds where with wireless and streaming and the internet and, you know, the future as far as media is concerned, it's going to be all electronic-based. It won't be CD or DVD. Either be hard memory or just simply downloads or streaming off the internet for all your media. Even on your personal devices, they all communicate now with the internet. And so as far as, you know, media is concerned, you know, things have really changed. And streaming and sending signals to different locations and all this sort of stuff is becoming very desirable just by the changes in the formats. And people just are listening to more music now than I think ever before because of the availability of the music and the devices that they play their music on.
It's a convenience, which in a way trumped quality with MP3.
I was just about to say that the only downfall is that we started at the bottom and we got to work our way up in terms of sound quality. But you know, speeds of links and internet and the size of memory nowadays is getting so large that this is not going to be an issue in the future. You know, there's a lot of people, you know, downloading high-definition videos off the internet, and it won't be long before it's much more popular. And so I don't see that as a major stumbling block. In fact, it's a bit of a boon for companies like PSB who are trying to push quality and value. that generation of people who are listening to MP3s, if they could just take the opportunity to listen to a good demo with some even affordable loudspeakers, they would buy into the merits of maybe upgrading to better formats and better systems to play their music back on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're hoping for.
Yeah. What about the concept of wireless speakers in terms of transmitting the audio to them wirelessly? For example, radio frequency, rear channel speakers, that sort of thing. Is that something of interest to you?
Well, if we do any wireless, that would be one product that would be definitely on the list, is a wireless surround loudspeaker.
Mm-hmm.
And to take it the next step, I don't want to tell too much because then people start asking for it, but I can see in the future multi-channel systems where the system is sophisticated enough that it can physically locate the speaker, physically locate you, and adjust all the levels and time delay for all of the multi-channel systems, no matter where you are in the room.
Mm.
And that has a lot of appeal to people who are looking for systems that are very powerful in terms of their sophistication and technology, but very easy to operate because they just have to push one button. And that's the goal. I mean, we want to make systems that are easier to use with much more technology in them. And you,
right.
keep your eye on this over the next, 12 to 18 months. We're going to have some interesting things happening.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to that. And I see by the clock on the wall that we've run out of time for this week. So I want to thank you, Paul Barton, for wonderful conversation and some great insights into a variety of topics. Be sure to check out Paul's website, PSB Speakers, at psbspeakers.com for all the latest information and what might be coming down the pike here. You heard it here first. Online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. And you can email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be John Atkinson, the editor of Stereophile magazine. And I've got a lot of questions to ask him, so I hope you'll tune in for that. Until then, geek out.